I'm up on the tight wire.
I'm in Studio B, sitting across from my good friend, Daniel Chacon.
And I'm in the arena, sitting across from my good friend, Benjamin Alira Sainz.
And welcome to another edition of Words on a Wire.
Today, we have a local poet. We have Gabe Gomez. He's from El Paso, lives in Santa Fe. But his first book, The Outer Bands, was the winner of the University of Notre Dame Andres Montoya Poetry Prize. He was the second winner of that. And his new book is called The Seed Bank, and it is put out by Mouthfeel Press, which is a local press run by Maria Maloney, a graduate from our bilingual MFA in creative writing.
And he'll also be reading our poem of the week.
Absolutely. Ben, as we're recording this show, we are on vacation. The holidays have passed, but we have a little bit more time before school starts. At least I do. You're the chair. You have to start work today, mister.
I'm on the job.
But one of the things that Ben and I have started doing, do you want to tell them what we do now, Ben?
Daniel Chacon and I go on a date on Wednesday nights. It's the Gay Straight Alliance.
Every Wednesday night, we go to the movies. And we've already seen two, three movies. The last one Ben chose, and so I get to choose this time because I thought it was very...
We saw Les Miserables. I loved it.
And it was miserable.
I loved it. Daniel hated it.
And I love musicals. Don't get me wrong, but it's just that there was like crying from the first 30 seconds of the movie all the way to the end. And you know, I think you need to
take
sympathy.
A sentimental journey.
And I loved the actors. They were very good. The cinematography was excellent. The imagery was out of sight. But one thing I didn't understand is it all takes place during the French Revolution, or one of them, I should say. And there's this little boy, this little French kid, and he talks with a Cockney accent. I don't understand.
And it really bothered you.
What's this little French kid doing a Cockney accent
for? You know,
one
time you said that about a poem, you have to give yourself over to the poem.
Right.
Sometimes you have to give yourself over to the movie.
Oh, you know, I gave myself over to the music. I thought it was lovely. I thought the singing was great, but I just could not submit to the entire movie. I got a little bored, but it was okay.
I was sitting right next to you. You got more than a little bored.
And I know people love that movie, you know, and so I'm not trying to disrespect anyone's aesthetic choices, but I just thought that it was, you know what it was? It was because we knew all the actors. We knew Anne Hathaway, and we knew that, what's the name of that guy that played Wolverine? Hugh Jackman. I think we just have goodwill right from the beginning. You know, we enjoy it because of the cultural phenomenon as opposed to because it's a sound work of art for the screen. Anyway, so I had to endure 2.5 hours of it.
So you're going to pick what movie for this week?
So this week I'm thinking of either two movies, Django Unchained, and I'll talk a little bit about my reservations on that, and maybe The Hobbit. Which one would you choose?
I want sheer entertainment. I want The Hobbit.
Well, Django Unchained is pure entertainment. It's like a spaghetti Western set in the times of slavery, from what I understand. My reservations about it, of course, are that there are some black activists, including the filmmaker Spike Lee, who boycott the film because they don't like the way it depicts slavery. They feel that it depicts it like a spaghetti Western, like a MTV video, like a action movie, and they feel that the reality perhaps is not very accurately represented. But I don't know. I haven't seen it yet, so I'm thinking maybe we should go see it. And
decide.
Either that or we could go see The Life of Pi.
Which I've already seen, and I thought it was a beautiful movie.
Oh, you already saw it?
Yes, I did.
Are you dating someone else, man? I thought this was our thing, man.
Other movie that I just loved?
And what?
I thought the book was fine, but the book was good, but the movie was great. The Perks of Being a Wallflower.
The Perks of Being a Wallflower.
It's a wonderful movie.
I didn't read the book or see the movie. But I did go see This Is 40.
Oh, how was that?
It was good. It was good. I could definitely relate to it because, you know, I've been 40 for 10 years now.
I've been 40 for 18.
And so there's a lot of funny aspects to it that you could only really get if you're in your 40s. And I thought they did a very good job with it.
So maybe the next show that we do will be a movie show, books to movie show. And we'll make something of that, you know?
Absolutely.
Make lemonade, make chicken soup.
Except, you know, here's my theory on, or my belief on movies that used to be books. First of all, if it's a literary book, if it's something written by, you know, somebody good, the movie cannot even come close to it. However,
it ain't necessarily.
However,
so,
let me finish.
And let me tell you that, because the hours. I liked the movie The Hours better than I liked the book.
Okay, well, I agree that there probably can be some exceptions, especially when we are filtering this idea that I have through individual personalities, because clearly we might like other things more than others. But I mean, in general, I don't think you can catch the complexity, the levels of a literary masterpiece and put it on screen. However, I think popular fiction books, John Grisham, I think the movies are much better than the books. So if we're going to do a movie to book conversion, I would rather do like Pop Fiction, because Pop Fiction works like a movie in your head anyway. And so to see it on screen actually is probably what the movie's made for. I think a lot of Pop Fiction writers write novels thinking it's going to get a movie deal.
You're a very smart and wise man.
Oh, why, thank you, Ben. And you just might get lucky tonight, and I'll buy you some popcorn.
And you can buy me some popcorn, and I always, always, always drink Mr. Pibb.
I sometimes sneak wine into the movie theater, those little tiny bottles of wine, and I pour it into a cup. And
heard
Asians
here.
Do it. Why not Americans?
You heard it here first, folks. Stay tuned.
We have Gabe Gomez. Join us.
Gabe Gomez is a poet and a music and culture journalist. Gabe has taught English and creative writing at the University of New Orleans, Tulane University, the College of Santa Fe, and the Institute of American Indian Arts. He holds a BA in creative writing from the College of Santa Fe and an MFA in creative writing from St. Mary's College of California. His poetry, prose, and essays have been published widely. His first book of poems, The Outer Bands, won the Andres Montoya Poetry Prize from the University of Notre Dame Press in 2006. His latest poetry collection, The Seed Bank, has been published by Mouthfield Press. He is currently the Director of Communications for St. John's College of Santa Fe. Welcome, Gabe Gomez.
Thanks for joining us, Gabe.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on.
Where are you right now? You're in Santa Fe?
I'm in Santa Fe, New Mexico, yeah.
When you're not writing poetry, what are you doing in Santa Fe?
Well, my day job, as it were, is I work for St. John's College. I'm the director of communications there, which means I kind of oversee the marketing and the promotion of the college. So I do everything from, you know, write the press releases to events and kind of just promote it, you know, in any way possible. So distributing news and that sort of thing.
You were here in El Paso a couple of weeks ago reading from your new book, The Seed Bank. You mentioned, I think, that you had a radio show. Is that true?
Yeah, actually, I have a long history with radio. I've had several shows.
You got a great voice. I'll tell you that right now.
Oh, thanks. I've been practicing. Now, it was music, live music shows. It kind of began as an idea that I had to host. I'm a music journalist. I also write. And at the time, I was a columnist here for a weekly alternative newspaper called the Santa Fe Reporter. I had a column there. And they invited me to come on the air a couple times, and I pitched a show and about, you know, just live music, you know, play music in bands. And so they said, yeah, sure, come on, you know, let's see how it works. So I did that. It was called The Junk Drawer, and I did that in studio for 3 years. And then we took it on the road, as it were, to a couple of places. Here there was a microbrewery here, Second Street Brewery, and this other really wonderful restaurant called El Farol. And so I did it for about 3 years, which was great, but it was incredibly time-consuming.
Yeah, tell us about it.
it was a lot.
Yeah.
And then, you know, here and there, having you know, having some shows. I'm really into music. I actually got into writing through music. It's a longer story, but yeah, it's one of the many things that I kind of keep myself busy. That's a great thing about Santa Fe. It's a small town, and if you have, you know, a lot of interests, it's, you know, you can kind of exercise those.
Do you listen to music while you're writing poetry?
Not too much. I feel that at this point in my life, approaching 40, I need to concentrate as much as I can on the page. Right. And that really requires a closed, locked room with, you know, very little natural lighting and just kind of really, you know, really similar to a bar, I would say.
Wow.
But not quite.
Do you like working in the dark?
You know, I got to tell you, I do. With the lights turned off and the curtains drawn, very early in the morning, as, you know, the sort of the daybreak comes along, that's really the sort of ideal time for me.
Can you talk about why? Or that's just the way it is? No, I'm serious.
It's really for me. I find I'm most lucid at that point. I found that if I write at the end of the day, everything that's happened in that day informs the writing in some way. And I think obviously, you know,
bad days?
we all have bad days, and we all have really great days, right? But the point is that I think being able to have that moment of just repose and being able to make sense out of it really start and on my own terms, because I don't have control of that at the end of the day, because there's so many things in my head, you know, right, where I'm exhausted. Whereas in the morning, I have the ability to make sense of it, to make some kind of, okay, this is, you know, say for instance, I'm working on a specific line or whatever. It's really an issue of control. And it only lasts for maybe, what, 2 or 3 hours tops. So. Right.
Robert Olin Butler has this book called From Where Dreams Come, I believe the title is. It's a very popular book on craft. And he says the reason why he writes first thing in the morning, before he looks at emails, before he listens to radio, before he even talks to his wife, is because language is fresh. And there's no separation between the language of the dream, which is rhythmic and imagistic, and the language that you're using in your poetry or fiction. Whereas at the end of the day, you've been using language all day in deceitful ways, and that has an effect on it.
That was an interesting thing to say, Daniel.
I didn't say it. I'm quoting. Perfect. So I understand that, but why the darkness? Why not natural light? I mean, I know I also write in the mornings, and I know Ben writes in the mornings. A lot of writers I know write in the mornings, but we love natural light.
Sure. Well, aside from being a vampire, I'm kidding. No, but I'm so easily distracted. The thing about it is, and here's where I've kind of boiled it down to it. I'm making, within those 2 or 3 hours, that little window of time each morning, I'm making decisions of what to include, of how to make sense. So it's everything is very sort of lockstep in a way. And anything that can distract me from that is an issue. So if I can control anything, I'll control the environment. I'll control, you know, the temperature or whatever else. But again, it's really is, maybe these control issues, I'm not sure. But it's really just a sense of I want to make the decision, and I want to make it on the terms that I need to make them on. Whether the poem is telling me to do this, whether it's I'm just kind of putting it aside. Maybe it's a piece of language, it's a piece of text I remember. Even if I just sit there and think for 2 hours, it's an opportunity for me just to, again, just to really sort of play off of that. And you know, my poetry, I depend a lot on the page. I see it in a lot of ways as a canvas. I see it in a sort of very painterly way. So it's very much a composition in looking at, well, what color and what balance and what shape and how is it going to look on that page? And so there's a lot of things going on. And so the light, I mean, it's funny enough. It's just something that I can internalize myself a little more. I can center myself a little more. The most important thing, I think, is really slowing myself down a little more.
Do you write on a computer?
I do. and that's really it. And it becomes really this intimate space. And again, it's just, you know, your painters depend on the light, the sort of and the hues, photographers, the same thing. And for me, it kind of almost the same thing in the sense of I need to know that it's morning. And you could say to yourself, well, I can create this sort of artificial environment in that it's any time of day, but I always know it's morning. You know, because my mind is sort of functioning in that way.
Right.
So.
Right. I'm the opposite. I really need to know. I have to be in touch with whatever the physical landscape is outside. That comes inside. I need that. I really do. And if I'm writing a long time, I literally have to step outside for 10 minutes and then come back in.
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure.
I write in my office and at home, and I have these French doors, and they go out into the balcony. I face those French doors, and right outside is the SM Mart in Juarez. I can see the parking lot and the little white buses going back and forth.
Oh, sure.
But that I feel it connects me. Now, let's segue to your poetry. You were, Gabe, you were the second, I believe, recipient of the Andrés Montoya Prize in Poetry. That must have been a big deal for you as a poet, to your very first book to win such a prestigious prize. Can you tell us about that?
You know, it was a pretty tremendous thing. Of course, Cheryl Luna, who I have tremendous respect for.
A graduate from our MFA in creative writing.
She was the first winner. And, you know, it was a really interesting thing that happened with that first book. I was I was living in New Orleans, and this was 2005 of August, and I had submitted a chat book to Francisco Aragon, who I know worked a little, and this was kind of on a lark. I know that he had worked with St. Mary's College on a few projects in California where I did my master's work, and, you know, I was familiar with the prize, and I guess it was a year before I sent him a manuscript of, like, what do you think about these poems? And at this point, you know, I had completed my MFA. I was teaching at a university, and I was really in this place where I didn't know what my poetry was. You know, was it this sort of, I was really interested in, you know, these sort of grand ideas of language and some other things. And then I was just really remembering my love of language and why I started doing it in the first place. So anyway, the point was, is I sent it out. So I didn't hear anything for a long time. Again, this was sort of kind of a cold, blind call type thing. And then Hurricane Katrina hit New Orleans. And
you were there.
I was there. And actually, my wife and I, we lost our house because of it. So in the middle of this, we were at a relative's home outside of Dallas, outside of Abilene, when I get this email from Maria Melendez saying, hey, I just noticed, you know, you're from New Orleans. I hope you and your family are okay. This really lovely email. By the way, we got your manuscript and we'd like to publish it. We want to know if you're interested.
You're talking about Maria Melendez, the Chicano poet.
Yes, yes, indeed. And I'm like, you've got to be, this was 4 days after Katrina. So I'm like, I'm homeless at this point, quite literally.
Wow.
And then I get this email. So I'm like, you got to be kidding me. And so, of course, I said, well, thanks for the email. Of course, you know, as you know, you just got to, these opportunities are few and far between. And so we ended up in Santa Fe. You know, my wife and I actually came to college up here. And so we knew we had some friends here. And it was a very curious time and, you know, very, very dark period in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
But we ended up here, and I was offered an emergency residency from the Santa Fe Art Institute. And I told them, I said, you know, I'm from New Orleans, but you know, I've got this book contract, and I need to finish it. I don't want to lose the opportunity. So they gave me a place to stay for 3 months. My wife went back to Louisiana to stay with relatives while I finished this book. And in the meantime, I found out about the prize, the poetry prize, the Andres Montoya. And they said, you know, if you feel that you have a book here, you know, you should maybe submit to it, apply to it. And so I did. You know, I worked and I wrote some, what I consider some really site-specific pieces, namely The Outer Bands, a long poem in the back of the book.
That's the name of the book, The Outer Bands?
The Outer Bands, correct. And I was back in New Orleans in, I guess it was 2006 when I got the call from Valerie Martinez, another really wonderful poet who judged the prize that year, saying that I'd won.
Awesome.
And it was a tremendous time.
Jeez,
you know?
So through all that destruction and sadness and darkness, there came
a book.
There came a book. That's awesome.
Came a book, and it was on top of that to win that prize was just a tremendous thing, and still is. I mean, I'm still very, very proud of it.
Let's talk a little bit about your new book, The Seed Bank. It just came out, and this is your second book of poems. What's different about this book?
Well, I think if you look at the composition of The Outer Bands, my first collection, it has remnants of my master's thesis, and there are some poems that may have been included in there, some poems that I was emotionally attached to because they had been the first things that I ever published in journals and things. Of course, the Outer Bands with, you know, that series of poems. In a lot of ways, it's different. The Seed Bank is very much, in a way, my first book, I guess, if that makes sense. I and it was funny because I was trying to make sense to it myself. You know, when that turn happened for me after the book. When I reached a place where I thought to myself, this is a voice in which I really want to embrace. It's literally for my first book, because it was such a cacophony of sources. This is a book where I sat down and I said, this is what I want to address.
So in your aesthetic, you seem to be something of a minimalist. Who are your poetic heroes?
Well, if you consider Dwight Twombly a poetic hero, Alexander Calder, a poetic hero, John Cage, and then there you go.
There you go.
Quite literally. I mean, it's my influences are really from the visual. I mean, Wallace Stevens is probably, you know, Michael Palmer, Wallace Stevens, Lynn Higinian. So, I hang out there a little bit.
You hang out there.
But I really yield towards more of the visual minimalists. And so, again, I'm obsessed with the page in a lot of ways.
Is there a struggle in you to write, on the one hand, a meaning-based poetry and then a poetry that challenges a meaning-based poetry?
Well, one of the things that a never-ending question that I have is language, and how is language reliable in what I'm trying to, is it a reliable tool in what I'm trying to say?
The answer is yes and no.
Precisely. And the thing, and it's an open-ended question in that I look very deeply at the mechanics of language. I'm interested in sort of the beginnings of language as someone who's bilingual, especially growing up in El Paso. I'm interested in where this idea of meaning both in English and Spanish meet, in a way. I've tried to write in Spanish. I did another interview recently, and they asked me if I wrote in Spanish. And I said, you know what, even though Spanish was my first language, I find it really unnatural, in a way, to write in Spanish, probably for my inability. And there's a considerable amount of distance in my skill set in actually being able to write in Spanish. But the point is that it's a question that's always there. In the question of meaning, of what I'm trying to do with these poems, it's really trying to answer of, am I capturing this correctly? And the word, and you could define the word correctly in a number of ways. But at the same time, with this new book, with the seed bank, I think I had something to say. And I wanted it to be maybe interpreted in a kind of way, in a certain way, not to sort of provide in a sort of an expository sort of position, but certainly one of, this poem is about this. And you can take it in a number of ways, but ultimately I want to address the fact that what do you do after loss? Where do you pick up, and what are the things that you use to start over? And that's really one of the motivations that I had. And a lot of it, again, it's with this, not to dismiss this set of poems, but the new book is really a big part of it. The question is, well, you got to go home. And home for me was increasingly, you know, El Paso, and not running away from it, or not actually making art from this thing.
I have to mention that your book is put out by Mouthfeel Press.
Yes.
And Mouthfeel Press is started a couple of years ago by Maria Maloney, who was a graduate from our MFA program. And it started off very small. She was doing chapbooks and an anthology of El Paso writers. But now she's part of the distributions, part of the consortium. And tell us about the experience of going with Mouthfeel Press.
My first experience with the University of Notre Dame Press was really wonderful in a lot of ways. I mean, it was as ideal as you can get. Working with Francisco and Letras Latinas was, I think, a real gift for somebody like me who was really, frankly, green in the literary field. I'd written for years. I'd been, you know, through two creative writing programs, but the actual industry end of poetry was brand new to me. So I feel very lucky to have been helped and continue to be helped out by you know, Francisco and Maria and others. But with this book, my mind was different. My mind frame around this book was very different, and I wanted to find an independent press that would sort of take it where it needed to be, you know, taken. But I think I wanted I wanted to be a part of the process. I wanted to be a part of the conversation, a part of the editorial, because that part of it intrigued me. And in Maria and in Mouthfeel, I found a very welcoming home. You know, Maria, I found to be a very astute reader, and to be quite honest with you, you know, she understood what I was trying to do. And that was a blessing, quite frankly. And El Paso, you know, I don't want to sell that short that, you know, it's a hometown press. I think she produces wonderful books.
She's doing a good job with it.
Yeah,
she's,
I think
you
she's
know,
doing
I
really
mean,
well.
Every press has to start somewhere, and she started it, and she's doing well. And I think having your second book is a gift for Mouthfeel, just as much as I'm sure it is a gift for you to be published by them.
Thank you for saying that. But I think it's great, and I think the treatment, the book, and certainly the finished product, and I think it's been just as great as an experience. And, you know, part of it is, you know, I grew up listening to punk rock, man, and so, you know, you know that indie sort of you know, do-it-yourself sort of thing. You know, I'll be 40 next year, and part of that, I want to remind myself that, you know, I write poetry because I don't want to be part of the flock. You know what I mean? I write poetry to put a stamp on things. You know what I mean? And so, and I think she understood that.
We're talking to Gabriel Gomez here on Words on a Wire. And Gabriel, we always ask our guests who are poets to read a poem because we have a segment called Poem of the Week. Could you read us a poem for this week's segment of Poem of the Week?
Sure, I would love to. I will read a poem called Clovis Culture, and this is from the Seed Bank. And a little explanation. One of my former students at the University of New Orleans, she and her husband they train racehorses. And so we were having a conversation one day during office hours, I think, about the names of racehorses, like how those funny names, you know, come about. And so she kind of explained to me how it's, you know, blood lineage and all kinds of different things and how little bits of the language are broken in to sort of fit in. So what might seem like a really, you know, silly name if you know, just look on these on some of these web pages for these, you know, for racehorses, whatever, it's actually a very complicated system which tells everything about not only of the value of the horse, but really the animal's history. And I found that just to be absolutely fascinating. And so I wrote a poem about it. And anyway, this is Clovis Culture. My friend explained the reasoning behind naming racehorses. Bits of broken dialogue, tongues of sire and dams effused through blood or breeding. More anthropology than etymology. Think for a moment of the horse's ambient body as code or cursory history, the animal's map. In illo tempore, the spirit succumbs, pit fires cloud the floodplain momentarily, ash, movement, more ash. Syllables veer from the burning, from conjecture, from the dominant voice. The horses, imagine, gallop blindly in unison, until they hobble, their hooves impress the groomed earth, scoop fistfuls of clumped dirt aloft and onto the track, when they pass.
That was Gabriel Gomez reading from his new book, The Seed Bank, put out by Mouthfill Press in 2012.
Gabe, thanks for being on Words on a Wire.
Thanks very much for having me.
Thank you for listening to another edition of Words on a Wire.
And thank you, Gabe Gomez, for sharing your thoughtful words with us. Thank you, Ben, for going to the movies with me tonight to go see We Don't Know Yet. I'm Daniel Chacon.
And I'm Benjamin Alida Sainz. And remember, if you can't read a good book, go to a movie. But the thing about movies is the next movie you see will not save your life. But the next book you read
might be turned into a movie. See you next week.
I'm up on the tight wire. One side's ice and one is fire. It's a circus game with you and me. I'm up on a tight rope. One side's hate and one is hope. But the top hat on my head is all you see.